So this paper focuses on the anonymous commentary on Plato's Parmenides, which was disengaged from a 6th century palimpsest in 1873 and was ascribed to Porphyry by Pierre Hadot. Well, I should make clear from the outset that the authorship of this commentary is not my primary concern, although I will argue that Hadot's hypothesis is still plausible, even if some of his arguments seem unpersuasive to me. Well, I'm inclined to think that this commentary is best understood as a work that reflects the early Neoplatonic philosophical debates around Porphyry and Iamblichus, so that ascribing it to Porphyry is an economical hypothesis, although it is far from being certain. Well, in his interpretation, Hadot puts special... You all have your handout, isn't it? In his interpretation, Hadot puts special emphasis on a couple of pages. This is Folius 93, recto verso, 11-12. And this section is fragment number 5 in Hadot's edition, and is given the telling title Lettre et l'Etain. So you have this in your handout. These are copies from Hadot's Porphyre et Victorinus. You have both Hadot's translation and the footnotes, which are very important, and I will refer to the footnotes in my paper. So in the course of this argument, the anonymous commentator describes the first one as infinitive being, être infinitif, aine, and contrasts its status to that of subordinate participial being, on or usia, which is proper to the second one. So building on this passage, Pierre Hadot draws a very ambitious conclusion, for he claims that the anonymous commentator conceives of God as an activity of being and carefully distinguishes its status from that of a form or essence. So, according to Hadot, il y a là un moment historique capital, découvrant pour elle-même la pure activité d'être, la philosophie était sur le point de s'engager dans des voies nouvelles. End of quote. Therefore, Hadot sees the commentator as the first to have developed what Gilson regards as a typically Christian doctrine, that of God as acte d'être. Well, this ambitious conclusion is not completely persuasive, in my view, although the anonymous argument is philosophically very sophisticated and deserves close scrutiny. So in order to assess Hadot's interpretation, I will focus on this crucial passage and try to set it against its historical and philosophical background. At columns 11-12, the author focuses on the one of the second hypothesis of Plato's Parmenides, i.e. the one that, as Plato says, Parmenides 142b, partakes in usia. So the relevant lines from Plato's Parmenides are at 142b, Hora de exarches, hen eiestin, area oionte auto enaimen usias de me metechein. So note that the autonomous commentator mentions the formula metechein tes usias several times, at in Parmenides 11.3.4, 6.9.10, and 12.7.10. So in line with Plotinus' metaphysical reading of the Parmenides, the anonymous commentator equates the one of Plato's second hypothesis, i.e. the one that is, with the second principle of the metaphysical hierarchy. But since Plato says that the second one partakes in usia, there must be some sense in which being and usia can be ascribed the first principle too. The first principle must be conceived of as some kind of paradigmatic being or usia which the second one partakes in. And this is all the more problematic since the commentator supports a very rigorous version of negative theology concerning the highest God or one, which is above all, as is shown by section 10 of his work. So the question is, how can the negative account of a perfectly simply one or God, that is, without qualities and bereft of any form, be reconciled with the positive description of it as an usia? This is the challenge the anonymous has to solve in fragment 5, where he does his best to make sense of Plato's claim. So the commentator explores two solutions in order to solve this predicament. In the first solution, he makes sophisticated use of the peripatetic theory of definition in order to explain the difference between the first and the second one, as well as the participation of the second one in the first. In the second solution, he distinguishes a verbal state of being and acting, einai, energein, which is proper to the first one, from a participial state, on, or usia, and energeia, which is proper to the second one. So, according to him, there are a verbal being before essence and a verbal acting before activity. Furthermore, he claims that a verbal state is somehow the idea of being. We will come back to the issues later on. So in this precise sense, we can say that the second one partakes in usia. So I will first tackle the first solution, which is at columns 11, 5, 21. So you find it in your handout, page 98 and 100. So you have Addo's edition with the translation and the footnotes. So here the commentator sets out the relation between one and being against the background of the peripatetic theory of definition and essential predication. So he equates the relation between one and being to that between animal and rational in the definition of human being. You can check at 11, 10, 11, ento exegetico tu anthropu logo. So there is a reference to the theory of definition. In this definition, one has the position of a genus, like animal in the definition of human being, whereas being, or rather, as the anonymous says, the property of being, etu einai idiotes, has the position of a specific differentia, like rational in the definition of human being. Therefore, this is the sense of the first solution. The status of the second one is similar to that of a species, similar, not identical. One is the genus, being is some kind of differentia, and one being is the object of the definition that is composed by the genus plus the differentia, just like human being is composed by animal plus rational. At the end of the passage, the commentator interestingly distinguishes this relation from that which holds between an accident and its substantial subject. You can check at 11, 17, 19, kai ukestin parathesis henos kaiontos, e il vocaminon mento hen, os sium bebecos detto einai. In this situation, we would have a mere juxtaposition, that means that the subject is independent from the accident and that the two do not form a single whole. Things are different with the relation between one and being at the level of the second principle, for this entails a mutual alteration of them. The verb is synelloiotai. So the verb synelloiotai is certainly not intended to convey the connotation of a quasi-alteration, quasi-physical or corporeal alteration of the two components. Rather, the anonymous aims to show that from the composition between one and being, a unitary entity comes out, what he, at 11:20, dubs tis idiotes hypostasios, une certaine individualité hypostatique, according to Addo's translation. So in this peculiar hypostatic character, the two components are perfectly unified and the one has a different status inferior to that of the first principle. As the anonymous say, at this level, at the level of the second one, the one is not pure. So 11.8 and 11.21 and 22. So let's focus on the anonymous use of the verb metekein. So you find it at 11.12. Well, as noted earlier, the anonymous has to make sense of this verb, of the verb metekein, for it occurs in Plato's Parmenides at 142b. The anonymous, however, makes an interesting use of it. In its exegesis, this verb does not really designate the, so to speak, vertical relation that holds between the second and the first one. Rather, it designates the, so to speak, horizontal relation holding between one and being at the level of the second one. According to Adot, this peculiar use is indebted to Plato's Sophist, where Plato employs metechein in connection to the koinonia, i.e. mutual participation, of the supreme genera. In the case partaking in ousia, in this case partaking in ousia would simply mean being completely intermingled with ousia or something like that. So according to the anonymous, when Plato says that the one partakes in ousia, it would merely mean that each part of being is at the same time one and being, and each part of the one is at the same time one and being. Well, this is a very plausible hypothesis. I mean, Adot tries to make sense of this horizontal use of metechein in the first solution proposed by the anonymous. I would add some further considerations, some further remarks. We may recall that this passage in the commentary is full of references to Aristotle's logic. And metechein has a logical meaning in Aristotle, is a logical term. For example, in Aristotle's Topics. And this logical use of the verb is well known to Porphyry and to the Neoplatonic commentators. According to the logical meaning of metechein, A partakes in B if and only if B is a predicate of A and A admits the account of B. Well, it seems to me that it's not impossible that the anonymous had in mind this logical use of metechein too, which would perfectly make sense for his argument. So, according to my hypothesis, this horizontal use of metechein at the level of the second one can also be related to the logical use of metechein in Aristotle's theory of predication. But there is a problem with this hypothesis. According to Aristotle's logical definition of metechein, what partakes in something admits the account of the participated atom. For example, human beings admits the account of animal. The anonymous, however, follows Plato's Parmenides and claims that the one, i.e. what corresponds to the genus animal, partakes in ousia, i.e. what corresponds to the differentia rational. So if we read metechein according to its logical meaning, we should infer that the name and the account of the differentia, i.e. of rational, are predicated of the genus, i.e. of animal. And it is false, and Porphyry rules out this hypothesis. Rational is not a constituent differentia of the genus animal. It is a dividing differentia. Still, the anonymous makes clear that is focusing not on the pure one, but on the one that is, i.e. on the one at the level of the second principle. You can check at 11.8 and 11.21 and 22. So it is as though we were considering the genus animal not in itself, but insofar as it is a component of the definition of human being. So animal insofar as it is the genus in the definition of rational animal. It is interesting that Porphyry considers such a distinction when he distinguishes between two statuses of the genus, the so-called unallocated or akatatakton in Greek, i.e. the genus taken in itself, and the allocated, i.e. the genus insofar as it is the genus of a certain species, katatetagmenon. We have some fragments in Simplicius. So if we adopt this distinction, we can allow for the possibility that the genus allocated to the species, i.e. animal in the definition rational animal, or one in the definition one being, participate somehow of the account of the differentia. Insofar as it is the genus of human being, animal admits the name and the account of rational. Similarly, insofar as the one is not pure, but is allocated to the one being, we can say that the property of being is predicated of it and that it admits the account of being or ousia. So as seen earlier, the anonymous makes the situation clear when he talks of a mutual alteration, sune loiotai, between one and ousia. According to Adot, these lines contain some allusions to the Stoic theory of mixture. So the anonymous would actually conceive of the unification of one and being at the level of the second principle as an example of stoic fusion, of stoic synthesis, as distinct from blending and juxtaposition, where the unified components are modified and merged to form a new item. Well, note, however, that the term synthesis does not occur in the text. Furthermore, the anonymous dubs the relation between the accident and its substantial subject a mere juxtaposition, parathesis, and this would be an overt reference to the Stoic classification, according to Addo. Porphyry's Summita Zetaemata provides a very interesting parallel for this approach, for according to Heinrich Dörrie, its famous hypothesis, Porphyry makes use of the Stoic classification of mixtures when he has to express the peculiar relation that holds between soul and body. This relation would paradoxically unify the characters of synthesis and parathesis. This hypothesis is very intriguing, but I don't think it's very persuasive. As a matter of fact, the only possible allusion to the Stoic classification would be the anonymous use of parathesis, and only this term. There is no mention of the other types of Stoic mixtures, neither synthesis nor crasis. And no mention is made of the term mixis at all. So the same reservations hold for the passages from the Isagoge and the short commentary on the categories, which were, according to Addo, Porphyry makes use of the Stoic classification in order to express, on the one hand, the relation between an accident and its subject, and on the other, the relation between the constituent parts of a substance. There are parallels with it. For this view. Well, there are some remarks by Jonathan Barnes. One can agree or not agree with the style, but I think it's correct what he says. The Stoic terms are not found in the introduction, nor is there any covert allusion to them. The Stoic doctrine of mixtures has nothing to do with predication, and the distinction between essential and accidental predication is as Aristotelian as apple pie. Well, we cannot rule the hypothesis that the Stoic classification is somewhat behind the anonymous account of definition. It's quite possible, but this hypothesis cannot be proved, and the background of the whole section is peripatetic, it's not Stoic. The anonymous equates the status of being to that of a property. And this view, in my opinion, suffices to disprove the general hypothesis that we have here, something like a theory of the act of being, but I won't focus on this issue. Well, the status of being is that of a property, i.e., what the anonymous calls etu einai idiotes. Let's check at 11.8. It's a very important passage. So we have the etu einai idiotes, which is somehow this kind of differentia, which is combined with the genus one, so that we have the one being at the end. As Addo suggests, and I refer you to the footnote number 4, which is a really masterly footnote in Porphyria Victorinus. There you have all the references and a magnificent analysis of this dossier by Pierre Addo. So, as Addo suggests, this expression, et vena idiotes, can be rendered as la propriété que l'être, where the genitive to enai defines what kind of property it is. Then we have some lines below, at line 20, another occurrence of idiotes, tis idiotes hypostasios. You can check it at page 100. But there, idiotes, as Addo suggests, and I think he's completely right, has a different meaning. There, the genitive means something like the property that belongs to being. We have a genitive d'appartenance, as Addo suggests, i.e., the distinct reality that results from the unity of one and being. So in the structure of the second one, the property of being has the status similar to that of an essential quality or specific differentia, i.e. a quality that is essentially predicated of its subject. I would say something more about the anonymous use of idiotes here. Idiotes is a well-known term in imperial Hellenistic philosophical writing and means something like proper character, property. Porphyry employs this word in a famous passage from the Isagoge. You have in your handout, I think, it's page 7 of the Isagoge, line 21, busse. There, Porphyry calls the individual a combination of properties, aphorisma idioteton. And the same view appears in his short commentary on the categories at page 129-910, you have it in your handout too, where Porphyry replaces aphorisma idioteton with the expression syndrome puioteton, which also occurs in Dexippus' paraphrase at page 30 of his commentary. You don't have in your handout, I think, Addo makes reference to Dexippus in his footnotes. When Simplicius paraphrases Porphyry, he has instead syndrome sium bebecoton. And you have this line from Simplicius in Addo's footnote. Le texte de Simplicius, to de arithmo, diesteken, osa syndrome sium bebecoton, ten idioteta, tes poikeias hypostasios aphorisato. Which also occurs in the as syndrome sium bebecoton. I think it's very interesting to citing the passages from Porphyry's and Simplicius' commentary in extenso. So, first, Porphyry. Eidopoiois men gardia forais, u dienenoken Socrates Platonos, idiote tides syndromes poioteton, kathen eidopoio dienenoken Platon Socratus. And then Simplicius. Ode arithmo diesteken, osa syndromesium bebecoton, ten idioteta tes oikeia supostasios aphorisato. It's worth noting that in these two passages, the terms poiotes and sium bebekos have the same meaning as idiotes in Porphyry's Aisagoge, i.e. they mean property. So, whereas in the Aisagoge, idiotes means property, here you have poiotes and sium bebekos with the same meaning. Instead, both in Porphyry's commentary and in Simplicius' commentary, idiotes has a meaning that is very close to the second meaning of the anonymous, idiotes hypostasios, which is quite the same in Simplicius, by the way. So in this case, the word idiotes denotes the distinctive type of reality of the individual, which results from the combination of qualities. It's a bit complicated. I will try to sum up. The anonymous employs idiotes in two different contexts. The word can mean both the property of being, et vena idiotes, at line 11-8, and the property that belongs to being, i.e. the distinctive reality of type of reality that results from the unity of one and being. And this is idiotes hypostasios at 11-20. And both usages of idiotes are attested in Porphyry. The first one occurs in the Aisagoge, the second one occurs in Porphyry's commentary on the categories, and in Simplicius' paraphrase of Porphyry. This might indeed be nothing but a sheer coincidence. I don't want to say that it's proof, that this is a proof that Anonymous is Porphyry, but it's certainly an interesting coincidence. Let's come back to the property of being. As noted earlier, in imperial philosophical writings, idiotes usually means proper character, and the term is virtually interchangeable with quality. So we might indeed speculate that, unlike qualities, idiotes merely belong to one subject, so they are somewhat like tropes in contemporary philosophy. But this is an implausible conclusion. Nothing suggests that idiotes has this distinctive connotation, i.e. particular property, and for example, in Porphyry's Aisagoge, in the passage you have in your handout, we find the view that the combination of properties, and this alone, belongs to exactly one individual. This seems to entail that each single property belongs to many subjects, or at least that each single property belongs to many subjects de jure, even if there is only one instantiation of it. This hypothesis is further confirmed by the lines that follow, where Porphyry talks about the idiotes of the universal human being, and adds that they belong to all particular human beings as human beings. Porphyry assigns the same meaning, i.e. property, character, to the word idioma. So idiotes and idioma are connected in Porphyry. More on this below, which is well attested in Hellenistic philosophy, for example in Epicurus, and occurs several times in Porphyry. So when commenting this passage from the Impermenidem, Addo aptly refers to several parallel texts from Porphyry's logical works. You have in the references in the footnotes of Addo's commentary. Such passages deal with essential definition, with the relation between hypokeimenon and sium bebekos, with the theory of essential constituent qualities, with the relation between genus and differentia. All of these parallels do not provide any cogent proof that the anonymous and Porphyry are the same person, but tell us something interesting about the anonymous philosophical profile. Is well at ease with peripatetic technicalities, there are several interesting parallels between his arguments and Porphyry logical works, and he makes use of Aristotle's theory of definition and predication when developing his views about the first principles. That's what we can say. While these remarks do not suffice to show that the Anonymous is Porphyry, they at least show that the Anonymous is a post-Porphyrian commentator, at least in my view. There are indeed several allusions to Aristotle's categories in pre-Plotinian Platonists, but they cannot in any way be compared to the Anonymous' sophisticated use of Aristotle's logical theories in his theological discussion. There is nothing like that in Middle Platonism. And here I completely disagree, I must say, with the recent, and in my view somewhat confusing, article by Gerard Bechle, The Anonymous Commentary on Plato's Parmenides and Aristotle's Categories, where he tries to antedate this use of Aristotle in the theological exegesis of Plato's Parmenides. He tries to antedate before Plotinus. In fact, there are no clear hints that something like that happened before Plotinus and Porphyry. So I will now focus on the second solution, which is by far the more famous one. It is 12:22:35 in Hado. So page 104 and 106. 22:35. So as noted earlier, there the commentator ascribes an infinitive status of enai and energein to the first one, and contrasts this status to ousia and energeia that belong to the second one. So we have some kind of being and acting as characters of the first one. So this passage can indeed be set in parallel with Plotinus' treatise 6.8, the famous treatise about where Plotinus developed some kind of positive theology of the one. Both Plotinus and the Anonymous first develop an outline of the first one according to the principles of negative theology, and then set out a positive account in which some determinations are ascribed to the first principle under precise conditions. In addition to this structural analogy, Plotinus' account of the first principle in 6.8 as activity, energeia, appears to be similar to that of the Anonymous commentator who ascribes verbal being and acting, enai energeing, to the first one. Some differences between Plotinus and the Anonymous are important too, however. Plotinus claims that energeia is prior to ousia, so that the first principle, while not being ousia, can nonetheless be characterized as an energeia. This is its distinctive form of reality, hypostasis. The Anonymous commentator, instead, sees both on or ousia and energeia as aspects proper to the second one, and which cannot belong to the first one. See lines 24 and 25. Tohen to epeken ausias, kai ontos on menukesti ude ousia ude energeia, energei de mallon, kai uto, to energei katharon, oste kai uto to enai, to protuontos. So we have energein and enai, and they are contrasted to energeia and ousia. So it is not correct to talk about an activity of being, as referring to this passage. There is no activity of being. Activity is proper to the second one, according to the Anonymous commentator. There is acting and being, and they contrast it to activity and substance or essence. But there is no activity of being at all in the commentary. So the first one is rather characterized by infinitive enai and energei. So unlike Plotinus, the Anonymous commentator sees both ousia and energeia as proper to the second principle and denies that they belong to the first. Well, that ousia and energeia belong to the second principle is Plotinus' usual view. Except in certain passages, the most remarkable being those in 6.8, ousia and energeia are both ascribed to the intelligible being, in Plotinus' words. What is peculiar to the Anonymous commentator is the view that the first principle has both being and activity in an infinitive form. This distinction between verbal and substantive being activity is puzzling, is very interesting and very puzzling. There is an interesting parallel, in my view, and this parallel is usually neglected, as far as I can judge, for this view. And this is given by the Stoic distinction between corporeal qualities, for example, wisdom, and incorporeal predicates, being wise. And there is a very famous passage from Seneca's letter 117. You have it in your handout. This is, of course, David Sedley's edition in the Hellenistic Philosophers. So in 33e in the Hellenistic Philosopher, you have the page from David's book. In this famous passage, Seneca informs us that on this issue, the Stoics followed the ancient dialecticians and parted company with the Peripatetics, who did not see any difference between the quality wisdom and the predicate being wise. According to the Stoics, the incorporeal predicate is the same as the sciable, the lecton. See letter 117:13, enunciativum quidam de corpore, quod ali effatum vocant, ali enunciatum, ali edictum. It is tempting to suppose that the anonymous commentator is adapting a distinction of this sort to his Platonic Plotinian metaphysics. In doing so, he reverses the order or priority established by the Stoics. While for the Stoics the corporeal quality, i.e. the substantive form, as a mode of being prior to that of the incorporeal predicate, the anonymous commentator sees the infinitive state as prior to the participial and substantive state. The infinitive state is somewhat akin to the idea of being, so that the second one can be said to partake in ousia. I'm well aware that this is a very speculative conclusion, but I would not regard it as a completely implausible one. At least, the Stoic theory provides a rather precise parallel for an otherwise somewhat cryptic argument, and the anonymous was certainly very well familiar with Stoic philosophy. There are passages, famous passages, where he makes sophisticated use of, for example, the theory of the cataleptike fantasia. So he was well at ease with Stoic philosophy. Furthermore, this would be a very nice structure to this section, for in order to show how the second one partakes in ousia, the anonymous would first be developing a solution that follows the peripatetic theory of predication and then another solution that follows the Stoic one. So let's sum up again the second solution. In order to explain Plato's claim that one being partakes in ousia, the commentator makes an interesting move. He posits a state of ousia that pre-exists intelligible being and may also belong to the first principle. In developing this view, the commentator possibly incorporates and adapts the Stoic account of incorporeal predicates into his own Platonic metaphysical framework. Accordingly, the commentator ascribes an infinitive state of being and activity to the first principle, enai energein, and distinguishes this infinitive state from the participial or substantive state that is proper to the second one. Unfortunately, the end of the text is cryptic, and I won't focus on it. I had a section on euparxis, but I will skip this section. I will rapidly move to the last part of my paper. Until now, I have not tackled the thorny issues of the authorship of this commentary. I will now bring a couple of arguments that are somewhat different from those put forward by Adot, but point in the same direction. Let's come back to the first peripatetic solution. It is very interesting to compare the anonymous argument with a passage from Iamblichus' reply to Porphyry, or the Mysteries. You have it at the end of your handout. In Safré, Segon, and Adrien Lesserre's recent edition of this work. There, Iamblichus criticizes Porphyry's use of the specific differentia in order to classify divine beings. According to Iamblichus, Porphyry distinguishes divine beings through characteristic properties, idiomata, which have, according to Iamblichus, the same status as specific differentiae. So, page 7, 20, I marked the wrong reference. It's 1-4, and I think you can find your... Yeah, exactly. Yes, it is there. Exactly. Well, accordingly, Jambricus holds that Porphyry finds in divine beings a structure closely parallel to that of species placed at the same level under the same genus. These are the members of an antidiasis. You can see the word antidiasis in at line 4. So in so doing, by making classes of divine beings species under the same genus, Porphyry completely misses the hierarchical relation between divine beings. So the logical background of Iamblichus de Mysteris is still to be fully investigated. Here I cannot dwell on this interesting issue, but merely wish to make a couple of remarks. The first section of Iamblichus' reply to Porphyry is very closely connected to Iamblichus' interpretation of Aristotle's categories, for what we know of it through Simplicius. And in particular, Iamblichus' account of divine hierarchy is based on his views about genera and species, and hierarchy of beings. In his interpretation of Aristotle's categories, Iamblichus focused on how we can express the relation between items that are prior and posterior by nature. And he aims to show that such items can well be seen as ranked under the same hierarchy or analogical unity of derivation from the same principle. But this hierarchical structure is completely different from the standard Aristotelian genus that is determined by its differentiae and is synonymously predicated of the species, which are placed at the same level and are simultaneous by nature. This type of genus cannot in any way express the relation of items in the same hierarchy. So Iamblichus' approach emerges, for example, when he criticizes Alexander of Aphrodisias for dividing corporeal and incorporeal items as if you were dealing with a single kind of substance, whereas in fact they have nothing in common. Ephon uden estiquenon. That's what Iamblichus says in Apud Simplicius. And it's very interesting to note the close parallel with Iamblichus' criticism in Porphyry in his reply at page 83 Saphresegon, Epiton mete koinonian usias mian. So, according to Iamblichus, it's quite crucial to state that there is no commonality of substance between different levels in the same hierarchy. Probably building on Iamblichus, Simplicius argues that such predicaments can only be solved if we transform our account of genus so that the genus is a hierarchical unity. In his reply, Iamblichus argues that Porphyry did not follow this approach and that he misleadingly regarded classes of hierarchically ordered divine beings as species ranked at the same level under the same common genus. According to Porphyry's mistaken approach, those species are determined by some idiomata which have the position of specific differentiae. So it is, in my view, very interesting that Porphyry's position about divine hierarchies as reported and criticized by Iamblichus is virtually identical to the anonymous first solution. As noted earlier, the anonymous regards the second principle as composed by the genus one and the property of being, the idiotes to enai. The distinction between the first and the second one is therefore not the same, but close, dangerously close, according to someone like Iamblichus, to that between two species under the same genus. The position of the anonymous idiotes is thus closely parallel to that of Porphyry's idiomata criticized by Iamblichus. There is indeed a slight difference, since idiotes and idioma are not the same word. These are, however, very similar terms, and both are in Porphyry with the same meaning, and they were regarded as equivalent. For example, we have a very interesting passage in Basil. It is about Basil's famous theory of proper names, where idiotes and idioma are completely interchangeable. So to sum up, both the anonymous and Porphyry make use of the repartitive definition theory per genus et differentiam in order to express the hierarchical relation holding between divine realities. This position employs the logical scheme of Porphyry's tree in order to convey the structure of a metaphysical hierarchy. Iamblichus criticizes this position as misleadingly leveling the status of divine beings so that to that of species under the same genus. And interestingly, Porphyry's view was not a commonplace position. Nothing, for example, suggests that Plotinus shared this position. For Plotinus overtly rejects the idea that items in the same hierarchy may be seen as species under the same genus. That's a famous passage in Plotinus' treatise 1.4, chapter 3. From this perspective, Plotinus and Iamblichus share the same concern. Again, I'm well aware that it's not enough to say that Porphyry and Anonymous are the same person, but it would at least suggest that they have a very similar philosophical profile and background. Finally, 2 minutes, I will focus on the second solution, the Stoic one, so to say, according to my suggestion. According to my hypothesis, the Anonymous makes use of the Stoic theory of predication in order to account for this participation of the second one in the first one. Well, interestingly, in the 3rd century Platonic philosopher Longinus also incorporated and adapted the Stoic theory of the lecton into his Platonic metaphysics. So if the Anonymous is here incorporating Stoicism into his Platonic metaphysics, the Stoic lecton into his, or the Stoic predication into his Platonic metaphysics, he was not the first one to do this. Longinus did something very similar, for he argued that the status of the ideas with respect to nous is similar to that of Stoic lecta. Therefore, according to Longinus, the ideas are outside the intellect and exist in a secondary way by supervening on it. So the Anonymous use of the Stoic account of predication, if indeed there is such a use, would reflect an interestingly similar attitude. It is important to recall that Porphyry had been a student of Longinus before coming to Plotinus' school in Rome. When he joined Plotinus, Porphyry initially held the same view on intelligibles as his first master. So he was very familiar with Longinus' account of intelligibles as lecta. It was only after an intense debate that Porphyry changed his mind. Furthermore, Porphyry was certainly very well familiar with Stoic logic and ontology. That's what we also noticed this morning. And it is tempting to speculate that Porphyry is actually the author of the Anonymous commentary and that he was drawing upon Longinus' general approach. If this were the case, Porphyry would thus have made use of the Stoic notions in order to convey the Plotinian distinction between the first and the second one. This is obviously a mere hypothesis, but I would say that it's not a completely unlikely one. I've finished.